Welcome to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete Sunshine 96.7 FM. Join us as we celebrate the sparks that ignite, the events that inspire, and the songwriters that create. With your host, Steve Robb.
Cozy Sheridan first caught the attention of the national folk audience in 1992 when she won the songwriter contests at both the Caraville Folk Festival and the Telluride Bluegrass Festival. Since then, she has played all across the U.S., from house concerts in Iowa to a full house at Carnegie Hall. In 2014, her release, Pretty Bird, was chosen as one of Sing Out Magazine's greatest CDs of 2014, and West Side Folk dubbed her one of the era's finest and most thoughtful songwriters. She's written about such diverse topics as the stock market crash of 2008, uranium mining, Greek mythology, aging in women, environmentalism, and a dog's loss of its testicles. So for the past 20 years, she's taught classes in songwriting, performance, and guitar at workshops and adult music camps across the country. And in 2008, she co-founded the Moab Folk Camp in Moab, Utah. So I think we all have a lot to learn. I certainly do. Welcome, Cozy. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So I think you and I are only two towns away. You're in Maynard, right?
No, I live in Harrisville, New Hampshire now.
Oh, okay.
I guess we need to update Wikipedia.
Well, I knew you had been in the area here for a little while.
I was, that's right. I moved in 2020 up to New Hampshire.
Okay. And is it any cooler up there?
It is. I believe it probably is. That's part of the reason, as I like the New Hampshire weather.
we're at about 95 degrees in the Boston area today, so it's wow. It's pretty brutal. So are you finding that is there a different type of music community up there? I mean, you're nationwide anyway, but is there something different up there musically that you're finding?
Well, you know, I started out up here. I started out in Portsmouth in 84 to 94. I lived in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. So I'm from the New Hampshire scene. And so it was sort of like coming back home. My old roommate lives, you know, 20 minutes away. And I have some, you know, I played in New Hampshire a lot. My family's here. I grew up here. So it's different than Massachusetts, but it's very familiar to me. And as you said, I tour all over the country, or I did until the pandemic made things difficult. So I still go back a lot to Utah and to the West, and I do my live stream once a week. So that's really kind of my presence now.
Right. And I have, when I can catch those on Tuesday mornings, I do. Tuesdays, I think at 10:30 on Facebook, right?
That's right. And YouTube. Yep.
Yeah. And I have, when I first started watching them, becoming more aware of you, I noticed there's a lot of capos.
That's one of the things that I do. I use a lot of capos. When I first moved to Portsmouth, I was a roommate with Harvey Reed, who is the person who runs the Third Hand Capo Company. And he introduced me to partial capos. So he introduced a lot of people in the New Hampshire area. Tom Pirazzoli uses them. And so I just started using them before I learned how to use open tunings. I used partial capos.
Yeah. I've got the one that is, actually I made one back when I was a kid. Somebody nicknamed it the Apo, which tuned my guitar to an A chord. And I think Kaiser still now has that now. And unfortunately I got no royalties from that because I did not submit it for, nobody knew about it but me. But then I ended up, a friend introduced me to the, capoing. I'm still usually conventional tuning, the capoing the five higher strings, letting your E become like your lower note, and like almost like drop D. And I found a ukulele capo is perfect.
It probably is quite perfect for that. That's right. Or a banjo capo.
Yeah, it's just the right length. So it is fun. So tell me a little bit about your, tell me more than a little bit. Tell me about your getting into this whole songwriting thing. 1992, I'm not going to even try to guess your age, but you didn't start out as a 14-year-old songwriter.
I did not. I left college in 1984 and moved to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and lived there for 10 years and learned how to be a professional musician. I played guitar since I was 9. My babysitter taught me in Concord, New Hampshire. And my senior project, I went to school in Exeter, New Hampshire. My senior project for high school was to learn how to play in a bar, make a demo tape, and learn how to do all those sort of things. So I was sort of on the road to that. But the songwriting you know, you have to have some life experience before you're going to really write songs that are of have much to say. So yes. I started writing probably when I was 23 or 24. And I did it by trying to write the songs that I was playing. You know, I just sat down at my table and said, I'm going to try and write a song.
So what were you studying in school? Was it something that gave you like worldly knowledge or perception?
I dropped out of college. I went back eventually, but I left Amherst in my freshman year. So I wasn't studying much. I just wanted to go. I went to Portsmouth because I went to an open mic at the Stone Church in New Market, New Hampshire in my winter break of freshman year. And I met all these musicians and I thought, this is a living library. So I went and moved to Portsmouth. My parents weren't delighted. and spent 10 years learning how to do it. And then I moved to Utah right after I heard about Kerrville. I'd written some songs. By 92, I had made one CD, but I was making a second one. And I entered Kerrville. I entered the Telluride Troubadour Contest. And when I went down there and won at Kerrville, it sort of introduced me to the country and introduced the country to me.
Sure.
It's sort of like a good housekeeping seal of approval. She must be okay. Let's hire her.
Absolutely.
So I started getting more national gigs. But as far as my songwriting, I'm really somebody who learned it. I'm somebody who learns on the streets. You know, I didn't go to school for it. I've learned it through doing it.
Mm-hmm. The topics that you write about are so wide and varied. And, you know, if you're writing about uranium mining, do you have to do some research? It's almost like somebody writing a novel about some odd, you know, something they're not necessarily personally familiar with. You've got to get your facts straight. Are you finding you have to do that?
Well, you know, I don't write a lot of those. I wrote Don't Go in the Water in 97 or 98. And, you know, I research what chemicals are being leached out of a uranium mining field. But most of my songs come from my own personal experience. So it was my story about, you know, you don't want to go swimming below the pile because it's full of uranium tailings. I probably research stuff when I'm onto a song and I need to learn something. I read The Big Short by Michael Lewis right about the time that the financial crisis was happening. Yep. And I read it three times and it interested me so much. I wrote a song with some of that knowledge in it, but I didn't decide I'm going to write a song and then go read a book. Songs have to sort of show up internally for me. It's got to be something I really am interested in.
Can you tell us a little bit about the song about the dog, the poor male dog?
Waldo. The Trials of Waldo the Dog. Yeah, that got me on the Dr. Demento show. I was visiting a friend of mine who was a headmistress of a boarding school in Palo Alto, California on the day that her dog went to the vets to get fixed. And I had written a song called Turbo East, and I put it out on my album in 1994 called Saturn Return. And that song, Turbo East, had gotten some reviews. And one of them had said, here's the latest in Sheridan's female complaint series was a review of the CD. So I was sort of on the path at that time looking for a male complaint.
Uh-huh.
Staying at Waldo's house, and Waldo goes to the vet one morning when I'm there, and he comes back the next day with a lampshade on his head. And he's lying outside looking absolutely bedraggled in the front backyard. And I thought, well, here's a male complaint. So I started it that way.
I haven't heard the song, admittedly, but I think I'm going to have to look this one up. Although I may have heard it when I was listening to Dr. Demento back in the day.
There was you might have. You never know.
Yep. It was always, I think, Sunday at 7 o'clock. It was a pretty regular thing. If I get the timeline right, were you playing guitar as a kid, or did you learn that as well after you left college?
No, I was. I started when I was 9, so okay. I was playing a lot of guitar. By the time I, you know, left, by the time I was 19 or so, I've been playing guitar for 10 years. So
all right. So were you active in the music programs at school, in high school, that kind of thing?
I went to a boarding school over in Exeter, Phillips Exeter, and I had a guitar teacher who played in bars. I was really lucky. His name was Eric Sinclair, and he said, you know, he helped me learn how to do this thing that I'd never even heard of. And he's the one who said, why don't we make you a senior project where you go into some bars in Portsmouth and we take you over there. And my father had to come with me because I needed a chaperone. And so I was 17 or something, and we went to the open mics in Portsmouth, and I'd play my, you know, my Joni Mitchell song and my Joan Baez song and whatever else I was playing at the time. And I made her recordings and learned how to do it. So it was really lucky that I had that guitar teacher in Exeter.
Sure. What was your first song? Was it something, you know, as a kid, was it something silly, or did you?
The first song that I wrote that I really still have it all, I wrote when I was about 20, 22 or 23. I was living in Portsmouth, and I had driven over from Concord, where I grew up, in New Hampshire, in a winter, in a winter snowstorm, and I had totaled my mother's car on Route 4. I mean, it was a very slow accident, but you know, you kind of plow into each other, and so her Subaru was totaled, and she was on vacation in Florida, because that's why I was borrowing her car, and I really was missing my mom, and I was 23 years old, and I was wishing my mom was there and could help me, and so I wrote this song called Lullabies, which is essentially about being sung to sleep by my mother.
Oh, that's
and
nice.
The chorus was was the first chorus I really wrote. What I did is I just used other lullabies. I know where I'm going, turn around. There's a long, long trail to where I lay me down. I mean, the chorus rhymes and it works, but it's four other songs that I put into the chorus.
Yeah. So what I'd like to do in the course of this interview, seeing as that you give so many courses, is let's get a free course here on songwriting real fast.
Okay.
Is there... do you have, I ask this of you because you do teach so much songwriting, and I have talked to other people who have taken your course and said how rewarding it is. People ask me, you know, are there rules you go by, anything like that? And I guess so. I'm wondering from you, if you were to say three or five things, whatever you want to call them, rules or fundamentals that you would say are the first things to learn, what would they be?
Interesting. I tend to teach more as in, let's try this and see what happens. And then
okay.
My teaching style tends to be a little different. It's try this thing out. You might not know what you're doing. You might not think you might feel like I'm throwing you in the deep end of the pool, but just see what happens. Go out and try. And then they come back and I sort of, you know, suggest, well, here's some things you can do about it. So my approach to songwriting tends to be, you already know how to write a song. You've been listening to the radio since you were 8 years old, most people, and you know what kind of sort of songs you like. So write a song that you like to listen to, try it. Now I do have suggestions that I'll give them on what to do when they bring it back. And in the editing phase, then I might say, okay, you've got a bridge there coming before your second chorus. Probably a better idea to have the bridge comes after the second chorus, because they won't know it's a bridge until they've heard the chorus twice. So I might have things like that that I think of as suggestions. But in general, I don't lay down rules so much as offer suggestions and then see what happens.
Got it. And I think that makes perfect sense. Because everybody's going to have something different. I'm not sure that was a trick question or not, but I guess I'm still wondering about some tidbits from you. But you know, it's everybody has to learn in a different way, and whatever their style may be.
Right. You know, some people are lecturers. I've just never been a lecturer, and I've often been teaching places where somebody else was lecturing and was giving a long assignment. So I, for instance, I created this thing called songwriting games, where you write a song in half an hour, see what happens. Which most people think, well, that's not going to be a good song. And you discover that actually in 20 minutes, you come up with a pretty good kernel of a song. Mm-hmm. Or I might say, okay, let's use three blind mice, see what happens if you do it. My teaching style tends to be see what happens when you do it. I'm teaching to adults who usually are doing this as an avocation. I think if I was teaching at Berkeley, like my friend Susan Catania, I would then be laying out rules, because those kids are coming through and they want to go make a living in Nashville or LA. They want to write for a living. And I'm more approaching it as teaching people who are looking for a means of self-expression and want to have some joy doing it. So I mostly just want to say, try it, see what happens. And, you know, then we'll play with what happens.
Yeah. With the type of guitar playing that you do, with a lot of capos, different tunings and that sort of thing, I find that most of the songwriting courses I've gone to have focused more on coming up with a compelling story or lyrics, that sort of thing. And I think sometimes at the expense of the actual music of the song. And I wonder how you balance those two in the course of your teaching, if one takes priority over the other?
It's a good question. I do feel that there's an awful lot in the singer-songwriter world of focusing on the lyrics to the expense, as you said, of a musical energy. I think of it as energy.
Yeah.
And my friend Cliff Eberhardt would say to his students, start with somebody else's song that day. Play some other songs. Don't just play your songs. And I feel that that is something that often people are starting out songwriting. They think, oh, I got to be working on my song. But if I, what I would suggest to people is, you know, I've written songs from other songs. You know, don't think twice, it's all right. I got a great song out of that by using that chord progression and playing that song and then moving it around, you know, trying things out and then changing it. So musically, I find that I use other people's songs to give me musical interest. I used to sit for hours and just say, how am I going to make this four-line melody where it's A, A, B, A, you know, the first line, second line repeats, third line's different, fourth line repeats. And I had very, they were labored. Whereas if instead I say, oh, well, I'm going to sing The Speed of the Sound of Loneliness by John Prine because I love singing it this morning. And then I'm going to see what happens if I just keep that guitar thing I was playing and that keep that chord progression and see what happens for me. And it's worked well for me musically. And I use it for my students. I say, okay, find another song and start with that. It just seems to be an easier way to do it. There's other ways to do it. I'm sure you can just go out. I could also give you a chord progression. Say, take this chord progression out and write a song to it. I don't think it'd be quite as much fun as saying, go out with, you know, a little help from my friends with the Beatles and see what happens.
Yeah. I've been teaching guitar online and to students who are just learning. And what they're fascinated by when I point it out are the bass lines and the step downs and the bass lines of, as the chord changes. And there's so much in a good song. You know, you can right. You can play G, E minor, C, and D all day long. And but if you add some other element in there, I think you can make it a little more interesting. And they're fascinated. They're listening to these songs like they've never listened to them before because of these bass lines that they never really heard before. But they emphasize so much of what the chord is. Anyway, it's very rewarding. You know, for me, I'm just teaching guitar with Guitars for Vets through online. But teaching music must be, teaching songwriting for you must be amazingly rewarding when somebody comes back to you with a song.
Oh, yeah, it's wonderful. I just did a retreat in Moab a couple months ago, and 15 people came, and most of them got a song that meant a lot to them out of it, and that's why I do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The song that we're going to talk about today, and as you said, you write a lot from personal experience, which is great, is called My Fence and My Neighbor, and I heard it, and I immediately reacted to it in a positive way. I've got a friend who he's a little bit of a sarcastic guy. He says, fence, it's an old line, fences make for great neighbors, you know.
Right.
And that's the first thing that came to mind here. But it has a twist to it, or maybe I don't know if a twist is the right word, but it does circle back, and you know, with a positive message. And was this something that did occur to you? Did happen to you?
Oh, totally. Yeah, it was in Maynard. So that song actually had a long history. In that, when I first moved, I lived in Utah, and I moved back to Maynard because my husband had a house there, and I moved into his house. And the house next door was empty, and it's Maynard, which is a very urban area, so the houses are pretty close to together. And the only thing between our two houses was two driveways, so it's quite close. Mm-hmm. But that house next door was empty. And it was empty for about 8 months, or maybe almost a year while I was there. And then I was on the road, and I called Charlie up, my husband, and I said, you know, here I am on the road. And he said, hey, by the way, some people looked at the house next door. They were going to rent it. He said, and they're two people are divorced, but they've just recently gotten together as a couple. And between them, he said, they have five teenagers. And I am, you know, somebody who likes my quiet. And I said to him, you know, we were talking about putting a fence between our driveways. Maybe we should, you know, if we're going to do it, we're going to have to do it now. We can't do it once they move in. It looks terrible. So we put a fence up between our driveways. And this nice couple moved in, and there's a fence there that wasn't there when they looked at the house.
I take it this is like a privacy fence, a stockade fence here.
Yeah, it was a lovely cedar fence from the Cedar Fence Company of Sunbury. Yeah. It's a fence that's high enough. That's right. So it's wooden and it's high enough that you have some sense of privacy.
Yeah.
So they move in. They're very nice people. We go over to meet them, and we slowly get to know each other. But I have inserted a fence into our, you know, situation. And So for the next, I don't know, 6 to 8 months, we live next to each other. And I realize these are super nice people. And I look over the fence from my upstairs bedroom window, and I watch the woman of the couple playing with her kids, you know. And then what happens is that in 2017, when, around the time of the change of administrations, the world starts to look a little bit chancy all of a sudden. There's all these protests, it's getting violent, the political world is becoming quite heated. And Charlie is away skiing, and I'm on my own in that house. And I'm realizing I wish I knew that woman better, because I would go over and have a cup of coffee with her. And I had lived in Moab, Utah for 20 years, and I knew my neighbors out there. I could go have a cup of coffee with them. And this nice woman, I couldn't, even though I'd been trying to get to know her. So that's where the song came from. And it's interesting that we're talking about that song, because I was writing that song for about a month, or maybe 2-3 weeks. And then I went to teach at a workshop I was teaching with Cliff Eberhardt and Sally Barris in Arizona in February, or March of that year. It was March, because I started in February. And I sat in the back of Sally Barris's songwriting workshop, and while I was trying to fix this song. So I'd be sitting back there with my napkin trying to rearrange how the... Because the first verse is very significant. When the neighbors first move in, I'm the one who built the fence. I'm the kind who can hold out her hand if I know my line of defense. And that's significant, how you start the song. And how I get into the song was going to be a problem. It's totally different because I sat in the back of Sally Barris's songwriting class, where she said, where am I? What do I want? How do I get there? And I want to give credit where credit is due. Sally Barris, that's what she says. It's said in her workshop. And I thought, okay, where am I? What do I want? And how do I get there? When the neighbors first move in, I'm the one, and I want, you know, but what I want this morning is my neighbor. You know, that's what the chorus talks about. So that's the story.
Oh, you got to make it longer than that, Cozy. I get time to kill.
And keep going if you want.
Well, please, of course.
Well, it's a song that I wrote while being at a workshop, which was useful because I think, you know, you get little ideas in people's workshops. The song has worked quite well. And we made a video where I said to the neighbors, who became a woman I really liked, I said, do you want to be in the video? We're going to make a video of this song about the fence, because she heard it. I put it on a CD. I gave them a copy, the neighbors, who, by the way, are super nice people. And in fact, said to me about 2 years after they moved in, they said to me, where'd you get that fence? Because we want to put one on the other side. So we made a video. Neil Eckstein came and did a video with me. And she came out. She's in the video, kind of coming out of her house while I'm pulling the trash can down. And that song became sort of, it had its moment online during that time, because it said something that I think a lot of people were thinking. We had like 30,000 hits when we put it out in the first 2 weeks, which was, for me, a lot. So.
Well, it sort of brings up first impressions of somebody, and how those first impressions aren't accurate, or can or may not be accurate, as you get to know somebody more. And
right.
You know, we've probably all experienced that in one form or another. My first impression of you was that you're very public, because you're on Facebook all the time, but yet you say you're rather private, which I guess, and I'm wondering, which one is it?
I think a lot of songwriters will tell you they're introverted, except when they perform, and then they have an extroverted side. You know, the other thing I was going to say about that song is I've been listening to a lot of Peter Mulvey when I was writing it.
Uh-huh.
And Peter Mulvey, he and I used to run into each other in the early 90s. We're both starting out. And somewhere between then and about 2005 or something, when I started listening to him again, he had changed something about his musical style. And I was studying it because I was very interested. Hmm. His voice seemed to be different. I was very interested. And I realized, wow, most of his melodies are descending. They're just a descending. They're not necessarily created. They don't seem that. And so anyway, when I wrote My Fence and My Neighbor, I just went, da 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 da. The melody is just descending lines.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I tell people now in my workshops, you know, use a descending line. They're really strong. Going up, it's harder to sound like you have a lot of authority. But going down, you sound like you have a lot of authority.
You know, it was about 2 weeks ago I interviewed Susan Catania. And we were talking about melodies and her term prosody, and that reinforces what's happening in the song, that melody. I wonder, I listened to the song recently, but I don't recall. Did your melody change as your perception changed, or you know, did it then become an ascending melody in a way?
The verses descend and the chorus goes up.
I see.
Da, 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 you know. And you know, it's the essence of, you know, repetition and change. The verses keep going down, so yeah, the chorus started going up, yeah, which is, if nothing else, it's a useful tool.
Another useful tool. We're getting these little snippets of lessons here.
Right. And that chord progression is exactly what you're talking about. It's G, E minor, C, and D. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
And the verse goes from the G down to the E minor, and the chorus goes from the E minor up to the G.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about your songwriting process.
Well, this morning, it changes over the years. Currently, and I say this to my students, I start every day by reading poetry. I try to read 2 or 3 poems and see if they might inspire me to write something in my journal, and then I'll just write for a while. I'm not doing it necessarily all the time, but if I'm home and I'm trying to write, that's what I'm doing. And then I will pick up my instrument. Either I've started playing ukulele and I love it, or the guitar. Mm-hmm. And I will just sit there and try and get some music into my body. I'm definitely somebody who wants to write from a somatic spot. Some people would write very, very intellectually, and I need the whole animal to be involved in order to feel it. For me, I need to feel a song. I need to feel your song when you're singing it at me, and I need to feel my song when I'm singing it for you. That's, I think, what makes music magic, is we feel something when we are, and we don't even know why necessarily. The music has its own emotional energy line, its own piece of information that's not, it's not in words, it's pre-verbal almost. We don't know why this melody is moving us, but it is moving us, you know. Why do we weep when we hear this hymn? We don't know why. There's thousands of reasons for either culturally or ourselves or just somehow viscerally that it makes us moves us.
So it sounds like you have, when you're writing lyrics, do you have a song in mind or do you actually have your guitar on your lap? Are you kind of doing the two in tandem?
I have a guitar in my lap, and often when I'm really starting a song, I'm in a place of emotional pain, and I want out of it. So the songs that really have a lot of energy for me in the beginning start at sort of a rant. You know, I have a song called "How We Come Apart," and the first verse is literally taken out of my journal of, "I don't want to hear how you're holding it together. I want to hear how you're coming apart. How you spilled your wine on the stairs, you threw out your back cleaning the closet, it's going to hell, do you care?" I mean, it's completely out of my journal. And I was in a very activated spot, as Charlie would say. So I'm definitely have the guitar in my hand, except that I'm writing, but I'm sitting usually on my writing couch. I've got a notebook next to me, I've got the guitar on my lap, and I've got my phone on voice memo next to me so I can record whatever I do.
Is this almost every day?
Well, since the pandemic, when we don't tour as much, it's quite often, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is your career. This is your full-time job.
Yeah, I teach at camps, I run camps, yeah, and I perform, yeah.
Right. But it is all music and songwriting.
That is,
you're one of those blessed few who have been able to make a actual career out of this. It's, wow.
I never had children. You know, you don't have children, you can afford to do it.
Yeah, that's true. Now, Charlie, you've mentioned Charlie. He's your husband. He's also your backing. He's your back line on Tuesday mornings.
He's my bass player and my harmony singer, and he tours with me. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are you back on tour again now?
You know, because we don't know. We've got gigs. Like, I'm planning to go to Texas in October, but, you know, it's a little mysterious what will happen between now and then. It's hard to book, you know, February in Port Orchard, Washington, when you're not sure what's going to be happening in February now. So my touring is not so far out, but yeah, we are. We're going to go out to Puget Sound Guitar Workshop. I'm going to teach at in a few weeks. Then I'll be teaching at the Summer Acoustic Music Week in Winnipesaukee. And then in the fall, we'll be starting to do some Cafe Lena and the Turtle Hill Folk Festival in Rochester, New York. So we'll start playing out again.
Uh-huh. Great. Cafe Lena is, I think that's the oldest open mic in the country.
It's certainly one of the oldest folk clubs. It might be the oldest open mic as well, yeah.
I think it was one of the first in Saratoga, New York. It's a beautiful place. Cozy, let's see. I'm looking through some lyrics here, back to your song here. And I was taken by these, and I feel like I want to give them a little bit more time.
I'll throw you an idea out of it, which is the bridge in that song is actually a verse. And most bridges, like a Nashville bridge, would be a climb. It would be two lines. And instead, I put the bridge in with a verse, which is, I'm not the first one to a protest. I'm the last one with a sign. I mostly want to be left in peace to make my own pretty designs. And then the bridge shows up right at the end of that verse, which is unusual. Usually you would have a bridge coming out of a chorus. And then it says, I wasn't certain when the neighbors moved in, but now I'm glad they're here. That is the bridge. It's a lift all of a sudden in the verse. The verse has been descending lines and the chorus has been ascending lines. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden we have something in the bridge that's ascending, which says, oh, it's a different animal. It's the bridge. And that line was the most important line of the song. I don't know from trade agreements. I don't understand all I hear, but I wasn't certain when the neighbors moved in and now I'm glad they're here. That was the hardest part to write, to figure out how do you say this thing without being too preachy.
Yeah.
And I'm not a big fan of preachy songs. I think the song has to be a song before it's a message, personally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that part of the song was definitely the place where I think most of my tool using came in. You know, I thought, okay, I'm going to have a flat seven chord instead of the 1-4-5 we've been using. It'll say, hey, different flat seven chord in the bridge.
And as I look at these now, I mentioned earlier that it was kind of a first impression song based on first impressions and as you get to know somebody. But you really, this is a song for that period of time in your life and all our lives when the world seemed to be going to hell in a handbasket. And
right.
we needed our friends. We needed somebody's hand to hold, or we needed a smiling face. And boy, we were also so stuck in our homes. And I live in a neighborhood here, and thank goodness I do. I mean, if I'd lived down at the end of a long driveway, I don't know what would have happened.
Yeah,
I probably would have parked my lawn chair at the road end of the driveway just to wave at people going by. I definitely need to have that. That human contact, but I think this is so. I think you've hit it on both points here. It's great. Did you have any other songs when I asked you for a song, was this the first one that came to mind, or had you debated a few?
I had debated a few. There's one called The Horse King that I wrote about my father. That's quite different,
mm-hmm.
But not. It doesn't have a chorus. It's not as much of a setup song. You know,
yeah.
Written based on a traditional Irish melody.
What you've got here is a unique idea.
Well, it's a very accessible melody. It's got a message that people relate to.
Mm-hmm.
It's not all my songs are that put together that much like a normal song, and that one is.
Yeah. So Cozy, you've got a website, I think it's cozysheridan.com, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And it says Cozysheridan, cozysheridan.com, and there's all kinds of information on there and about all the different courses that you teach. And I think you also do one-on-one mentoring too.
I do that. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I do.
All right. I may take you up on that offer one of these days.
All right. Thanks for
doing it. this has been really wonderful, and I thank you so much for your time. It's a great song, and as with all our podcasts, we will add the song right to the very end after we sign off. So thank you, Cozy. I really appreciate you being on with us.
Thank you, Steve. I enjoyed it.
Okay. Take care. And now Cozy Sheridan with My Fence and My Neighbor.
When the neighbors first moved in, I'm the one who built the fence. I'm the kind who can hold out her hand if I know my line of defense. We are living in interesting times. The sky falls every day, and I used to think my fence could make the world go away, but this morning all I know is I want to fall down and cry. This morning I don't need my fence, I need my on the other side. I've seen my neighbor with her children in the morning, She knows how to set and bend a rule. And I don't know that much about her, but I've dropped in and we've talked at her store. And each time I come away wanting to know a little bit more. And this morning, oh, morning, I don't need my fence. I need my neighbor on the other side. I'm not the first one to protest, and I'm the last one with a sign. And I mostly want to be left in peace to my pretty designs. And I don't know from trade agreements, I don't understand all I hear. But I wasn't certain when the neighbors moved in. Now I am glad they are here, 'cause this morning, oh, this morning I don't need my fence. I need my neighbor on the other side.
Thanks for listening to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete. If you like what you hear, you can find Song Creating on your favorite podcast app or at songcreating.com. To check out my own music, go to steverobb.com. And until next time, keep a song in your head and music in your heart. Thanks for listening.